You're listening
to a University of Kentucky.
University of Kentucky.
College of Arts and Sciences podcast. This podcast is from the 2013 Kentucky Women Writers Conference, made possible by the University of Kentucky. This reading features Paisley Rekdal and Kiki Petrosino as each author reads excerpts from their work.
Thank you. I'm going to read a few poems from Animal Eye and then some new work. A small, soul-colored thing. The dog walked out of the forest with the deer in its mouth. No. The deer came out of the forest. The dog ran beside it, over, under. The dog slipped itself into the animal lurching to my side of the road. One of its throats bent back to the sky. One of its spines dissolved to pear white belly. The throat was red, and the long legs looked broken. But I made a mistake. The legs were not broken. And the deer did not appear dead, though it must have been, animated by the dog's hunger, so that the deer moved when the dog did, shivered like the soul inside the body, the dog's face all red, which could be the color of the soul. The back of the dog was sleek and brown and expensive looking. When I stared at him, I could see the lawns he must have escaped from, the gravel drive winding down from the hills and the gold tags jangling at his chest, the clean pink flaps of his ears flushed with cold. Now they were froth-covered, and his eyes were glazed with a furious longing. The dog tore at the deer's throat as if he could dig himself inside of it. The dog became a dog again, and I watched him do it, and the deer became something else. It left the soft ash shape of the doe grazing by the bus stop. It abandoned the buck's bright energy leaping over the stone wall that separates my house from the cemetery, its low border taut as a muscle that herds of deer trace in moonlight, cast out of the canyons choked with snow. The deer became some shadow torn between us, beneath it the beautiful legs, the elegant ribs twisted into the road. I stopped and watched this wrestling, the dog half-deer, the deer half-dog, myself poised behind them so as to remain invisible, though a low, slow growl loosed itself at my approach. It entered the deer and reverberated there until its fur grew long and thickened, and its face took on the shape of a lion, a wolf, a bear. It became the shape of a mouth tearing and tearing as I watched it, wanting to take my share of it, kneeling at the walk and putting my mouth to the flesh, letting fur and blood both coat my tongue, while my hands reached into the stomach to rip and empty it. I wanted to loose my gray hair out upon my shoulders, to feel antlers grow from bone, letting my own heart be pierced until the soft pulse shivered in the skin. No. The dog tore at the deer's throat, and I watched it. I was the human that could watch it. I was the small, soul-colored thing that wouldn't change. The deer trembled and lay still. It grew slack in the deepening snow. The road disappeared, and the sky turned white. The snow piled up. It kept on falling. When you live in Utah, you see a lot of wildlife. Like a lot. Why some girls love horses. And then I thought, can I have more of this? Would it be possible for every day to be a greater awakening? More light, more light. Your face on the pillow with the sleep creases rudely fragmenting it. Hair so stiff from paint and sheetrock it feels like the dirty short hank of mane I used to grab on Dandy's neck before he hauled me up and forward. White flanks flecked green with shit and the satin of his dander. The livingness, the warmth of all that blood just under the skin and in the long, thick muscle of the neck. He was smarter than most of the children I went to school with. He knew how to stand with just the crescent of his hoof along a boot toe and press incrementally his whole weight down. The pain, so surprising when it came, its iron intention sheathed in stealth, the decisive, sudden twisting of his leg until the hoof pinned one's foot completely to the ground. We'd have to beat and beat him with a brush to push him off. That hot insistence with its large horse eye trained deliberately on us to watch. Like us, he knew how to announce through violence how he didn't hunger, didn't want, despite our practiced ministrations, too young not to try to empathize with this cunning, this thing that was and was not human we must respect for itself, and not our imagination of it. I loved him because I could not love him any more in the ways I taught myself, watching the slim bodies of teenagers guide their geldings in figure eights around the ring, as if they were one body, one fluid motion of electric understanding I would never feel working its way through fingers to the bit. This thing had a name, a need, a personality. It possessed an indifference that gave me logic and a measure. I, too, might stop wanting the hand placed on back or shoulder and never feel the desired response. I loved the horse for the pain it could imagine and inflict on me, the sudden jerking of head away from halter, the tentative nose inspecting first before it might decide to relent and eat. I loved what was not slave or instinct, that when you turn to me, it is a choice. It is always a choice to imagine pleasure might be blended, one warmth bleeding into another as the future bleeds into the past. More light, your hand against my shoulder. The image of the one who taught me disobedience is the first rite of being alive. I'm going to read one last short poem from this collection and then some new work, and then I'll be done. This poem, I actually started out as a medievalist and came to poetry quite late, actually. And one of the things that was quite interesting when you study medieval studies, of course, you spend a lot of time with Catholic theology. And the idea of what happens to you when you die is always fascinating to, I think, everybody. But there was a certain period in church history where there was a big debate, which is when you die and you go back up to heaven, which body do you go back in? The one you just died in, or like hopefully the hotter 35-year-old version of yourself? Or, you know, the one that didn't have its legs blown off in the war, the one before the, you know, cesarean scar, whatever, which self gets in? And I thought that was so fascinating. And there's all these images in medieval art of, you know, the souls rising up to meet their bodies in heaven. And I always wondered what would happen if you didn't meet yours. That was another big anxiety for the Middle Ages, which is, what if you get stuck in someone else's body? Because there's that big bum rush up to heaven, right? And who the hell knows what's going to happen to you? So this is a poem that's about that, and it references The Fly by David Cronenberg. Intimacy. How horrible it is. How horrible, that Cronenberg film, where Goldblum's trapped with a fly inside his material transformer. Bits of the man emerging gooey, many-eyed, bits of the fly worrying that his agent screwed him. I almost flinch to see the body later that's left its fly in the corner. I mean, the fly that's left its body. Recalling, too, that medieval nightmare, resurrection, in which each soul must scurry to rejoin the plush interiors of its flesh, pushing through, marrying indiscriminately, because heaven won't take what's only half. One soul blurring forever into another body. If we can't know the boundaries between ourselves in life, what will they be in death, corrupted steadily by maggot, rain, or superstition, by affection that depends on memory to survive? People should keep their hands to themselves for the remainder of the flight. Who needs some stranger's waistline, joint problems, or insecurities? Darling, what I love in you, I pray will always stay. The hell away from me. That's for my husband. No, it's not. That's just too mean. But it's funny.
This, I'm going to read two other short poems. I've been working in a lot of kind of more formally form poems, mostly just for the hell of it. And I wrote a whole series of sonnets to Mae West recently. And I'm going to read a couple from that series. And the sonnets, you know, Mae West's humor is extremely, you know, based on puns. It kind of turns in on itself. So I spent the sonnets, not just writing the sonnets themselves, as, you know, that structure, but also thinking about either turning them into anagrams of her famous one-liners, or I could only use words that were composed of letters of a one-liner that actually appears in the top of the poem. So I'm going to read a couple from there. And I will unfortunately be doing a Mae West impression, because when I was a kid, I used to dress up as her and do it all the time, much to everyone's horror. So a couple of things you might want to know about Mae West that should have appeared in one of these poems. She was a vegetarian. She never married. She never had kids. She also believed firmly in sunscreen and staying out of the sun. She refused to smoke. So some of the advice that comes here, you could imagine her actually saying. So this is an anagrammatical sonnet. Mae West, advice. Ban tobacco. Do bacon a bed. Be delectable, collectible, a decent debacle. Decollete, don't conceal, acne, do. Be bold and be toned, an octane blonde coed. Be colonel, not cadet, concede nada to doc. Date a cad and canoodle, be a clat on a cot. Don't lean on a deacon, be adult, a clone. Don't bet on an Eden, don't loot, don't loan. Be Bell and Ball too, a Deb Coco labeled. Be Ocelot, be Lancet, be candled and cabled. Cancelled, debated, booed at to boot. Elect to be tall, don't tan, eat local. Be Oded, caboodled, be beacon and lect. Oh, don't be a noodle, be cool and collect. Yeah. Anyway, so thank you. Thank you very much. I'll be here every Thursday. Or Friday. I don't even know what day it is anymore. Okay, the other form I was working in recently was the villanelle, which I think is probably the hardest literary form ever. It took me 6 months to do this poem, and that's pretty much it. I'm never doing another villanelle. But I can say, you know, I died, I did a villanelle, great. If you don't know what a villanelle is, I won't tell you because it's just too dispiriting to find out how hard it is. But the lines that refrain or kind of keep coming through, one of them is actually a line from a math article I read, which said that we should be less than dead. According to the perfect statistical plan of the universe, actually, we should be less than dead. It took me a whole week to figure that out. In a whole week. I'm not a bright girl. And so I kept mulling that over, and so that keeps coming through the poem. And I thought I would dedicate it, because it seemed like a very misanthropic thing to think about, and I thought I would dedicate this poem to Philip Larkin, who is one of my favorite misanthropes. So this is a koan for Philip Larkin. In the perfect universe of math, it said, the world's eternal aberration. In fact, we should be less than dead, math itself disrupted for matter ever to be read as real. A thought so hard to fathom that the nation, in its article on math, has said, we lack the right imagination. The human head will not subtract itself from the equation, zero out the eager ego to be less than dead. Did the numbers hunger for mistake, for fun, upend themselves to recalculate our infinite extinction? And was existence meant for all, since it could be said, without our numbers, others might have thrived, the black rhinoceros, short-nosed sturgeon? Articles of horn and scale, both less and more than dead, figurative dreams that now haunt us in our beds. Memories, another flaw in our equation. Was it the nation? I forget. Regardless, I know that someone said, in a perfect universe, we'd all be dead. All right, and then just a couple more, and then I should be finished, right? Oh, yeah, well, I got a little more time than I thought. Okay. This is a poem referring to a gestural painting, and a gestural painting is just one that's handwriting. And in this case, it was a single phrase written over and over and over and over and over in a circle and getting ever tighter. It's by Troy Passy. And the poem is titled after the line of his painting, which is the line he himself copied over and over. It's a line by Edna St. Vincent Millay. And that line is, "When it is over, it will be over. Hurricane of what must be only feeling. The painting's sentence circling to black on blank, ever tightening spiral of words collapsing to their true gesture, meaning what we read when not reading, as the canvas buckles in the damp, freckled like the someone I once left sleeping in a hotel room to swim the coast's cold shoals, fine veils of sand kicked up by waves where I found myself enclosed in light, sudden, bright, tunnel of minnows like scatterings of diamond, seed pearl, whorled in the same thoughtless thought around me, one column of scale turning at a moment's decision, a gesture I was inside or out of, not touching but moving in accord with them. They would not wait for me, thickening, then breaking apart as I slid inside, reading me for threat or flight by the lift of my arm, as all they needed to know of me was in the movement, as all this sentence breaks down to O's and I's, the remnants of someone's desires or mine, so that no matter if I return to that cold coast, they will never be there. The minnows in their bright spiraling, first through sight, then through memory, the barest shudderings of sense. Oh, and I, parting the mouth with the cry that contains but doesn't need any meaning." Vessels. Shouldn't it ache? This slit into the sweet and salt mix of waters comprising the muscle, its labial meats winged open, yellow-fleshed, black and gray around the tough adductor. It hurts to imagine it, regardless of the harvester's denials, swiveling his knife to make the incision, one dull cyst nicked from the oyster's mantle, its thread of red gland no bigger than a seed of trout roe pressed inside the muscle's tendered flesh. Both hosts eased open with a knife, as if anything could be said to be eased with a knife, so that one pearl after another can be harvested, polished, added to others until a single rope is strung on silk, linked by what you think is pain. Nothing could be so roughly handled and yet feel so little. Your pity turned into part of this production. You, with your small, four-chambered heart, shyness, hungers, envy. What in you could be so precious you would cleave another to keep it close? Imagine the weeks it takes to wind nacre over the red seed placed at the other heart's mantle. The muscle become what no one wants to, vessel, caisson, wounded into making us the thing we want to call beautiful. I'm going to end with one last poem, and this is, this is called Mortal Love. Oh, and I should just say one thing about this poem is that I was actually at a reading, and this poet did actually say that, and I was really, really quite taken by what he said, and so I thought about it afterwards and came up with this poem. Mortal Love. If we were immortal, the poet said, like the Greek gods, love would not be needed because time ceases to matter. Love needs urgency to be felt at all. At which point I left the hall, hurrying home to cook us dinner and change the sheets, to sit a moment and rest before you came back home to me, thinking all the time of the gods in our stories who, even with eternity to spare,
loved, which brought them into the human realms of war and murder, the chaining of lesser beings in pits of flame, the skinning of rivals, and the creation of children, sometimes beautiful, sometimes monstrous. The need for the shapes and skins of animals to disguise their desires, meaning the gods knew guilt too, and shame, and jealousy. They knew, as we tell ourselves, about all the human emotions in which love is rooted, self-love, and love for spouses, daughters, sons, other people's wives, the love for ex-lovers too, the secret old needs flamed out, but the ashes nursed out of respect for the failure. The gods loved because we wanted them to be like us. No, it is not an excess of time that would keep them from feeling it. Love embroiders time, moving in and out of what we imagine of it, or what, if we were gods, we could finally know. For them, death is the thing that is expendable. Eternity means only that suffering can be withstood because it can be forgotten, because we are the ones who must exist in the quick sharpening and dulling of whatever wounds assert us as human. If we are different from the gods, it is because we are more afraid than them. Our sweet, dim, ordinary pleasures necessary to assuage what can't be forgotten, an instinct where theirs is an indulgence, and so our love is deeper, more frightening, more terrible than theirs. The gods loved, but they loved only as like us as they could. They could never match it. They would never match it. And it is because of all the things they loved, eternity would teach them to covet most their power and their will. We have these things too, in abundance, but not time. For love doesn't need time at all. Thank you.
Our next poet is Kiki Petrosino. Her newest collection of poems, Hymn for the Black Terrific, was just published by Saraband Books, the wonderful literary press in nearby Louisville. Her other publications include Fort Red Border, also published by Saraband, and a chapbook, The Dark is Here. Her poems have appeared or are forthcoming in the New York Times, Tin House, and several others. She has been awarded 2 staff scholarships from the Breadloaf Writers Conference and a postgraduate writing fellowship from the University of Iowa. She currently resides in Louisville and teaches at the University of Louisville. Please welcome Kiki Petrosino. Thank you.
Thank you. Is this something that can be adjusted? Can I move this? Okay, I'm a bit too tall. Maybe. Okay. Yeah, I think so. Is that good? All right then. Okay. This woman's face is your future. I too have hated it. Something off about the teeth. Long and long I've studied on its shape, dumb as Domit, dulsome as Dallas ditchwater. Lantern head, I've said, happy horse bag, too bad to bleed. Just want to iron shut its mouth from hem to hem, want to break the nose down to a haw's hole. Could I gag it out, once gagged, I mean, with long, dry coughs of hair? Could I shudder it with one quick knot to the nape, snap it off in my hands, old blister pack, old zit? In my cabin, I'd snag that thing on the first nail, keep pulling it down and down by the jaw. Yes, and let them shreds hang lovely in the lamps. Only then would I give up a while, put on my sea gown, and rise beautiful on the dark decks. Ancestors. One rages white as wood. another sits ruined at the center of her realm. One of them broods over a clutch of old combs. One darkens like an oyster in the autumn smoke. There's one the shape of a ganglion and one like a yawl. There's one climbing up from the deep planks. You find a glass one, a leather one, a salt one. You watch one dissolve into the embrace of an oak. Already there's one drawing a fine grid on your forehead. There's one disjoining the cables of your wrist. One lives in horses, another in a warp of snow. One's a kind of luster in the mouth. You remember one who taught you to make a kerchief of your hands. Another came in a nightdress browned with spit. Sometimes you glimpse one moving through the woods or whispering through the slits of an iron rake. There's one who waits and one who weeps on the road. But you choose the one who blooms like a war by night, the one pulling another sheaf of your hair into her mouth. That one is always here. That one, that tender trench knife in the head. So in this collection, Hymn for the Black Terrific, I was thinking a lot about obsession and how obsession, particularly with a kind of bodily perfection, can kind of like warp our view of ourselves and the ways in which we see what we see in the mirror is not, in fact, more messed up than what actually is there. However, it's impossible for us to see, right? That's why I kind of wrote the ancestor's poem and the other, this woman's face is your future. But I'll read two poems now that were inspired by other things, particularly by some teachers that I had when I was a beginning poet and following. There's a professor at the University of Virginia named Gregory Orr, who I had the opportunity to study with, I wrote this poem kind of riffing on one of the titles of his books. It's just called Books. For the bolt of the body in the hinge of the darker door, when the beloved is a density of threads, concerning all ingots, all hinges, all belts, concerning the fastness where the body stalks, for the fin of white, which is the stalk of the beloved body, where to stalk, where to ride, where to strike. Where to strike the beloved in the body, for the armature that strikes at the beloved dark. Concerning the varieties of striking sounds in the body, for the beloved strike that strikes once. When the sound of the beloved is the wood of the pear tree, concerning the tree that roots in the beloved dark. Concerning the dark that branches the body, a sound through the branches of the beloved skin. When the braid of the beloved brushes the collarbone, when the breath of the beloved appears on a glass, beloved terraces, beloved darknesses, beloved doors. Concerning the door of the body which is a body's breath. For the burn of the body at the edge of the door, near the edge of the body of the beloved, a breath on the body of the beloved, on the body which is a garden of unfolding edges, for the garden where the beloved unfolds. And this poem, this next poem, I wrote for Dean Young, who was a professor of mine at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And I wrote the poem when he was awaiting a heart transplant, which he has since received and is doing great. This poem was written right when he was waiting for that transplant. This is called Cygnus Cygnus, which is the name of a species of swan. Cygnus Cygnus. To love a theory leaves no room for imprecision. Let us count. Here is a king. Here is a catfish. Here is a staff of office. Here's a sad-beaked animal nibbling at my poor snack cake of grief. Hello, sad animal. Turns out you're not making the swim back. Pythagoras argued that the souls of poets pass not from this world, but lodge themselves in the breastwork of swans. Let it be. Let some of us withdraw to the keel-shaped bones, to the tilted orrery of the thorax. But I think if poets coalesce as swans, we're mostly in the feet of swans, black as drums, pressing our rageful webbing into the earth's flank. The sound of a swan is no chemical thing, but a bloody hum thick with rivalry and blue weather. It's rage that moves the tongue of a swan in strange meters. It is only rage that pulls the tarso metatarsus back to the joint, like a bowstring stretched to the edge of its hungry self. Just so. You taught me to be warlike in my songs and still to praise the palm-sized stars brooding over their great darkness. I see how art is. It's a fine blast furnace, and my knuckles make an imperfect pomegranate delivery system. It's tempting to lie to the young. But you told us rightly about the beautiful dead flamingos holding up the continent and the thousands of microscopic bluebirds who once pinned the canopy of Iowa in place. Last time I passed your house, something with a beak and wings had pecked a line of punctuation in the stucco, then dressed each small exit with a different loosening fist of dry grass. I wanted to tell you, the neighborhood is full of unusual craft today, Professor. But instead, I let the moon swing like a lantern over the old sugary architecture of your road. To be a poet is to surface plainly from the wound of sleep, to observe how thickly feathered the heart, how small and bright the planet of human thought. When you tell the sky goodbye in your poems, it's awful every time. This last lesson moves beyond my study, but you remain with me as a winter sky, shot through with swans of iron, swans of steel. Let no harm come to the dark you have made. Someone counted, and they said that I used the word dark like 36 times in this book, and it's true, like, dark and black, and those images come up a lot in here, and I don't know why that is, but it has turned into a dark, rather dark little book. For that, I'm both proud and sorry. I'll read some poems now from the third section of the book, in which there's a personage, I won't say a character, but a personage that I call the Eater, who kind of capers throughout these poems. The section is called Turn Back Your Head, and There is the Shore. And the title of each section is taken from the name of a dish that I ate while in China. So the names have been translated into English. So just know that. Super milk flavor. Lately, the eater has begun to eat again. Egg yolks, guar gum, buttermilk solids spooned up from the pot. She shovels as if there were a metal for shoveling the mounds and mounds of sweetened matter. There is. At the Battle of First Manassas, they brought picnics to the field. They brought ladies in 1,000-pound dresses to stake down the slopes with their tuffets. Their arms cake soft inside the fragile bulbs of sleeve. Then sweetness was a fine thing, measured in earbobs and applejack. Just as each army attacked with two columns, you couldn't eat with your gloves on, nor have a tongue like the eater's, roughened on peanut gravel and threads of desiccated coconut. Now the eater tastes her own blood and understands the word abundance for the first time. It is salt and metal. It is the pulse of lecithin in the curve of every heaped spoonful. Happy is that eater. Happy is she who bringeth to her maw the thousands and ten thousands. Destiny comes together as a cold plate. The eater is lonely, so the eater eats. The huge white shark of her skull sallies forth across the teeming table. bleached as wool, the eye that broods for a time over tangles of microgreens, over thin scrapes of scallion. The eater breathes a muddy testament into the slaw. She's slow to sink, a catamaran turning on her hulls. In the east, where rivers fork into little cuts, where camels go vanishing down each rib of dirt, love is a rumor licking the eater's neck. There are halls in her head where a man might say his pilgrim name, where he might leave treasures and monuments, even the lips of him, even the cheeks. Such a man might carry through like the scent of wood smoke in a glove. It could happen. Crossing the bridge. When the eater dreams, she dreams of horses, surging up from the far grasslands of her ribs, seething across her throat's crescent. She burns her dream tongue on the smell of them, black as engine grease, sharp as switch cane in the mouth. White horse, yellow horse, horse with hunger in its kick, horse with teeth of blood and foam, blight horse, soon horse, horse of oil, horse of dirt and hair and windows breaking. How the eater's head fills up with storms of speeding animals, how they beat their hooves with rage of her. Awake, the eater scrapes her hair into a nest, tries to cough the horse taste from her throat. Nothing rings against the sink but sounds. By now, the eater can't keep from eating. All day, she pushes bread and birds down her gullet. She cuts her lips on half-grilled cactus. Her mind goes bright and strange as the meat of an egg. Is the eater a special girl? She is, a queen of flesh and plants, tall in the torso and famished from fang to forelock. Never full, though her gut hangs heavy in the dark of her dress, though her thighs press together like prayer. Her hate is a hooved body, galloping down halls of dust. She grows round and rounder with each white step. Two more poems. Moon-wrapped, fragrant spare ribs. Happy is that eater who rules by the cyclone of her face. By the syrup of her eye shall she drown the clanging earth. For the eater combs justice like beeswax through her hair, and her hands catch only righteousness in their fiery mesh. Therefore, lament neither the appetite that dismasts your cities, nor the emerald in her gut that spins. I tell you, the eater is more terrible than all your needlework of lemongrass, purer than aluminum, the eater's hum at eventide. Fear not her blue-black shadow as she cruises into your airspace. There's lightning in the matrix of her marrow. Her teeth make mirrors of the sea. The eater wants me to end with one last poem of her. This is the very last poem of the book. It is called 8 Renunciations of the Looking Glass. Inside every eater is another eater who rejoices backward. If the eater rejoices, then she does it with her teeth, an insect face. You may rapidly divide any face by honey, by silk, or by wire. Divided, the loaf of the face cleaves unto the eater, and the rest hangs. Divided or hanged, the eater seethes with blessedness. Just watch her sweep like a matador through the sick room, blessed, blessed eater, with skin like fiberglass and big wishes. It is most difficult to live on batter, or not to. Thank you.
This has been a presentation of the Kentucky Women Writers Conference and the University of Kentucky. For more information, please visit KentuckyWomenWriters.org.